It's here and now, and today, February 18th, is an important day in literary history. Perhaps you are celebrating. This is the day Mark Twain published his novel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, the story of the rafting trip that Huck and his friend Jim, a runaway slave, took down the Mississippi River. The book came under fire from African-American groups because they thought it was racist, but then Ernest Hemingway famously declared that Huck Finn marked the beginning of American literature. He said there was nothing before and nothing since as good. Mark Twain died in 1910, and per his request, his autobiography, which he had dictated, was held for publication until 2010. At that time, we asked literary critic Steve Ahman why Twain didn't want the book published until he'd been dead for 100 years.
Twain was actually, though he was a lover of invective and quite venomous when he needed to be, was actually a soft-hearted guy. And he knew that people were going to get hurt if he spoke totally forthrightly, you know, in his time. It was also, I mean, people say it was a great promotional trick or something, but I think it was really about sparing people's feelings.
And was that wise? Did you see things that maybe somebody might not have wanted to see in print?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let me read a passage that's about John D. Rockefeller Jr., who was the son of John D. Rockefeller, richest man in America, and also a sort of part-time religious commentator. Twain writes, "Young Rockefeller, who is perhaps 35 years old, is a plain, simple, earnest, sincere, honest, well-meaning, commonplace person, destitute of originality or any suggestion of it. And if he were traveling upon his mental merit instead of upon his father's money, his explanations of the Bible would fall silent and not be heard of by the public. But his father ranks as the richest man in the world, and this makes his son's theological gymnastics interesting and important. The world believes that the elder Rockefeller is worth $1 billion. He pays taxes on $2.5 million.
Ooh.
Wow. Not only is he suggesting that John D. Rockefeller Jr. is a daddy's boy who doesn't have a lot upstairs, but also speaking incredibly bluntly about the plutocrats of that age. How would that square in today's political world?
Well, I was going to ask you, because some people have said that because of this style of dictation that you mentioned, it sort of feels a lot like blogging.
Well, saying that Twain is like a blogger is sort of like saying Picasso is like a graffiti artist. I mean, there's a question of genius, but there's also a question of cultural context here. People don't realize Twain was not only the most famous writer in the United States, he was one of the most famous people. He was a moral commentator, he was a performer in great demand. I mean, if you imagine taking John Updike and combining him with Jon Stewart and Oprah and Bruce Springsteen, you'd start to get an idea of the magnitude of Twain's power in the culture. There was no mass media, and Mark Twain was looked at as a guy who was the genuine article and somebody who was a real moral authority.
Well, he was born Samuel Langhorne Clemens. I've gotten that name wrong in the past, so I want to accent it. And we know in a story that we did on a book about hoaxes that in his early days as a reporter, he would just make things up because he'd get bored.
Yes.
So do we know that this is all true?
Well, that might be the central comparison that can be drawn with blogs. We do not know if it's true. The book, I should mention, is kind of ishkabibble would be the Yiddish word. It's kind of, you know, a mishmash. It's not just a straight, I was born a young boy in Missouri. It's much more a compendium of rants and missives and some news dispatches. I was totally uninterested in the veracity, sort of the factual veracity. What we read Twain for his voice, for his moral perspective, his kind of cantankerous, wry, take no prisoners sensibility and sense of the world is why we read Twain.
Well, and you hear a lot of that in his description of a massacre in the Philippines.
Yeah, this is one of the most chilling and I think revelatory passages in the whole book. This is Twain responding to a telegram of congratulations involving this massacre of the Moros Indians in Philippines by the U.S. Army. His whole utterance is merely a convention. Not a word of what he said came out of his heart. He knew perfectly well that to pen 600 helpless and weaponless savages in a hole like rats in a trap and massacre them in detail during a stretch of a day and a half from a safe position on the heights above was no brilliant feat of arms and would not have been a brilliant feat of arms even if Christian America, represented by its salaried soldiers, had shot them down with Bibles and the Golden Rule instead of bullets. He knew perfectly well that our uniformed assassins had not upheld the honor of the American flag, but had done as they had been doing continuously for 8 years in the Philippines, that is to say, they had dishonored it."
Wow, assassins.
Uniformed assassins. Now, the amazing thing about Twain is he was, as he says, he was a red-hot imperialist for much of his early life. He came around to the idea that America was abusing its military advantage over other countries and being imperialist later on in life. So he was not some, you know, left-wing crazy. In fact, he was the opposite of that. He was a guy very much like Stewart or Colbert who targets hypocrisy and power, and he was continuously aiming for those throughout his career, whether in fiction or nonfiction.
That's literary critic Steve Almond on the new autobiography of Mark Twain. And we should say, too, that there's a huge sort of introduction before it starts, and then there's 400 or so pages or 300 pages of footnotes at the end.
It's like the opposite of a beach read,
whatever that is. It's a fall read.
That's right.
And tell us something you never heard before. Tell us something.
Well, I think one thing that comes through very clearly and quite beautifully is that he was a real devoted family man. Included in the book, and this is really charming, is the biography that one of his daughters, Susie, is writing about him, and he's quite taken with it. You can tell that underneath the cantankerousness and this incredibly sharp moral eye is a real father and husband who's very devoted to his family and has a real soft spot. And I should also mention that he's continuously in economic trouble.
Is he honest about that in the book?
Not only is he honest, but he is, to my mind, as a sort of writer who's struggling with some of the same things, he's enchantingly honest about his sense of grievance towards his publishers. He uses language that is untoward for the radio, and his relationships with these business partners, when the business goes south, he's really just very upfront about, like a lot of Americans can relate to right now, the guy was overextended.
That's Here Now Literary Clinic critic Steve Almond on the autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. We spoke in 2010. Volume 2 is now out as well. It also runs more than 700 pages.